watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3 Lancaster, Radio Veronica.us West Point, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, two historians on race, slavery, and freedom in America. In the first hour, John Marciano returns with his public discussion group on Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, with commentary on the function of race and slavery within empire. Then Eric Foner talks about the shifting politics of the concept of freedom.
Like lightning, we soon will be riding my shiny black bears. No fat rich man's pony can overtake you. There's not a rider from east to the west to hold you alive in this darkness and midnight when the pot-bellied beast.
This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. The following recording by the L.A. Sound Posse from June 21st of 2005 contains John's commentary on chapters 2 and 9 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States.
Okay, we're going to begin. Of course, everyone knows today's summer solstice, June 21st, the longest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. Today is also the 41st anniversary of the killing of the three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, June 21st, 1964. I was married that weekend, actually on June 20th, 1964. And in 1992, my ex-wife and I attended a memorial service at Cornell University when the class of 1962 at Cornell, where Mickey Schwerner, had attended, the class of 62 dedicated a stained glass window in Sage Chapel on that campus in honor of the three slain activists. It's actually a very stunning stained glass window, which has the Mississippi state flower, which I believe is the magnolia, and has the three of them. It evidently took the class of 1962 a little time to honor Mickey Schwerner and the other two young men who were killed. My ex and I reflect often, and certainly at this time of year, on the fact that the first, and I actually wrote about it years ago, I don't know what I did with it, the first sunrise that we saw together was the last sunrise that those three young men saw. As they died, it was a Sunday evening. Their lives, of course, and their loss are in the news just today, in fact. I mean, talk about a historical moment. A former member of the KKK was found guilty of the lesser charge of manslaughter. The jury was deadlocked on the charge of murder. He is the only person to face such charges in this case, even though a number of former KKK members and some, I would say, law enforcement officials from the state of Mississippi spent time in prison for violating the civil rights of the three young men. No murder charges, as far as I know, no murder charges were ever filed by the state of Mississippi in this case. And in this trial, a former mayor of Philadelphia, he testified, and Philadelphia, by the way, also made the news, Philadelphia, Mississippi, in 1980, because that was the site where Ronald Reagan began his campaign for president in 1980. Not an accident. It was a clear sign to white racists as to where Reagan stood with them in their resistance to democracy and racial harmony. He could have started his campaign anywhere. It's not an accident that it started in Philadelphia, Mississippi. So the mayor said when he was testifying that he knew some Klansmen at that time and over the years, and they were basically good folks, that the Klan did some good things and was a peaceful group. Okay, this is 2005, commenting on the past. This is what some whites in Mississippi believe about what we would call as American as apple pie terrorist groups that all of us in this room know conducted a campaign of lynching and other violence against blacks and some white allies for more than a century beginning after the Civil War. Another sign also in the contemporary news that the issues raised by Zinn in these chapters are still with us was captured in the recent U.S. Senate resolution apologizing for decades of lynching that went on in the U.S., in the country, nearly all against blacks and almost all in the South, more than 4,700 by official count. Now, one might assume in the year 2005 that such a resolution, which is a mere apology that didn't demand anything from the Senate or the government, would have sailed through unanimously. That was not the case. 20 senators refused to sign on as co-sponsors, including Ted Cochran and Trent Lott of Mississippi, the state which led the nation in lynching in U.S. history. 20 did not. Only 80 senators co-sponsored the resolution. I don't know. I tried to check today on the internet to try to get a list, and I was unable. So irony piled on irony, or contradiction piled on contradiction. The resolution was drafted in the Richard Russell Senate office building, named after Richard Russell, the senator from Georgia, who used to use the filibuster to block the Senate from voting on anti-lynching legislation decades ago. It seems to me, it's just another example, the failure to obtain unanimous consent for this resolution is another reminder of the poison that continues to afflict the body politic of this country, a poison that I will argue in my comments that has been in the bloodstream of the U.S. since its founding. The U.S., by the way, the government has never officially apologized for slavery. And there is a group called the Committee for Formal Apology who's trying to get that through the Senate. We'll see how many decades that takes. Okay, some prefatory comments to these chapters, which are really about the color line, the most divisive issue in U.S. history. A long and deep history behind the racist color line, deeply embedded in the Constitution. And as we examine the Constitution, with or without help from Justice Scalia, it is easy to see that the founders' original intent was racist. It was not benign or an oversight. The 1790 naturalization law, for example, in the U.S., restricted citizenship to free white persons, quote unquote. When Washington became president in 1789, slavery was already the foundation of social and economic life in the South, and racism, of course, was well entrenched nationwide, and slavery extended beyond the southern United States. The 55 men who drafted the Constitution included many slave owners, and a fact that really blew my mind, I mean, I'd known some of it. 12 of the first 16 presidents of the U.S. were Southern slave owners. I mean, ponder that fact for a moment. 12 of the first 16 presidents. From 1776 on, slavery plagued a nation that asserted the equality of all men, and the men who wrote the Constitution sought to keep the recognition of slavery out of the basic form of the new government, and you will not find the word mentioned in the document. In a sense, if we jump ahead in U.S. history a bit in these chapters, one might argue that the whole legal base of slavery was enunciated in the extraordinary statement of Roger Taney, Chief Justice of the United States, in the famous 1857 Dred Scott decision that upheld the infamous Fugitive Slave Law, essentially arguing that blacks had always been regarded in America, quote, as having no rights that a white man was bound to respect. The African-American scholar and activist W.E.B. Du Bois concluded that despite the unending effort that went into painting the claims and charms of the Old South, it turned the most beautiful section of the nation into a center of poverty and suffering, an abode of ignorance. On the other hand, of course, one must recognize that slavery's economic profits helped to fuel the rise of industrial capitalism in Europe and England, especially, and enrich the ruling classes of that area and not just the U.S. South. The institution was supported by founders such as Jefferson, Madison, Washington, and Patrick Henry, all of whom owned slaves. And of course, we all remember from our school books the famous statement by Patrick Henry in his opposition to British colonialism, "Give me liberty or give me death." Of course, he would never think of extending this eloquent plea to his own slaves. There was always resistance to slavery from the beginning in this country, and white owners continually remained in a state of fear and worry. Their greatest fear was the potential of a cross-racial class solidarity between whites and blacks. In many ways, perhaps still their greatest fear, especially if people understand that they have much more in common than indifference. Without resistance and slave revolts, without the abolitionist movement, and most importantly, without the greatest conflict in U.S. history, the Civil War, without the efforts of blacks in the South as workers and soldiers, slave owners would have never, on their own, ended the master-slave relationship. No dominant class in history has ever done that, and it has not happened in U.S. history. Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, brilliantly articulated this truth, and I quote, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess freedom and yet deprecate agitation want rain without thunder and lightning. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will." When we jump to the present, jump up ahead of perhaps 100 years, we have to see in the most recent struggles against racism, especially coming out of the human rights movement in the South, that the changes that have undermined racism in our lifetimes have all come from the toil and efforts of the oppressed and some allies. Never, never, never as a gift from those who oppress them. Freedom is never given as a gift. Douglass's 4th of July oration in 1852 also articulated the fundamental truths about slavery and the country. He said, "Your 4th of July is a day that reveals that your liberty and equality are hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, sermons and thanksgivings, fraud, deception, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up the crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages." In the epic conflict over race and slavery, Abraham Lincoln tried to take the middle ground. But he did not believe, as Du Bois and others argued, in equality between the races. His desire was to save the Union and neither to save or destroy slavery. And our view of him, for those of us who were brought up in U.S. schools, has been shaped by incredible myths. In his epic work on U.S. history, Black Reconstruction in America, Du Bois points out that Lincoln was not an abolitionist. He did not believe in full black citizenship. He tried desperately to win the Civil War without black soldiers. And he emancipated the slaves only on account of military necessity, adding 200,000 black soldiers to the Union Army and thus ensuring its victory. While all of us here learned the myth that Lincoln freed the slaves and the Civil War was about slavery, we must also recognize that as the war unfolded, the idea that it was to abolish slavery was even met with constant and indignant denial in the North. In the early years of the Civil War, Union generals permitted slave masters to come and remove slaves from within the Union lines. What Frederick Douglass said about the war was essentially true. It was begun in the interest of slavery on both sides. The South was fighting to take slavery out of the Union, and the North to keep it in the Union. The South fighting to get it beyond the limits of the U.S. Constitution, and the North for the old guarantees, but both sides essentially despising and insulting the Negro. End of quote. Du Bois's essential argument in Black Reconstruction is that the North started out to fight the war without touching slavery. It was not abolitionist and was overwhelmingly in favor of Negro slavery. But there was a minority who hated slavery and who wanted no union with slave owners, who fought for freedom and treated Negroes as men. They and their black friends and the new freed people became gradually the leaders of a reconstruction of democracy, that very short period in U.S. history when there was at least a minimal support by the national government in favor of democracy and freedom. After the Civil War, of course, Douglass and others called for an economic base to assist the newly freed people, but this did not happen, and the old efforts at exploitation came around and continued as before. Terror against blacks and white supporters began immediately after the war ended. As the South ignored the Reconstruction Amendments and civil rights laws, aided by the federal government in Washington, this ushered in a period of brutal white supremacy in the South, essentially between 1890 all the way through the 1960s. The official ideology in the United States was racist, and its ideal of racial purity most dramatically expressed in laws forbidding interracial marriage. Laws that continued until they were declared unconstitutional in 1967 in a case Loving versus Virginia. So through the 1960s, it was still illegal in, I believe, 16 states in the Union. And those prohibitions, by the way, when polling was done up through the 60s, were supported overwhelmingly by whites in the country. What did exactly white supremacy or apartheid in the South during this era, say from the late 19th century through the 1960s, mean to black people as a race? It meant the following. They could not attend white schools. They could not drink from the same water fountains. They could not relieve themselves in the same toilets. They could not wash their hands in the same basins. They could not eat in the same restaurants. They could not sleep in the same motels and hotels. They could not sit next to whites in public halls, concerts, on buses or streetcars, or any other means of public transportation. They could not be born in the same hospital or buried in the same graveyards. There were conflicts in the southern United States in the 1960s when the attempt was made to bury Vietnam veterans who were African American who had been killed in Vietnam. They could not be buried in cemeteries with white veterans. This is during the Vietnam War. They could not expect to live in the same neighborhoods. They could not hold the same jobs or attain the same standard of living. It was a system of apartheid. Except for a few, very few principled whites who were allies, during this entire period, there was no real outcry, protest, or outrage, especially in the South, but elsewhere in the country. But here we're talking about the South, from clergy, educators, business leaders, or politicians. It is crucial to understand that fact in history and to know that at every single stage in U.S. history from 1776, the struggle to extend democracy to blacks and other oppressed racial groups was vigorously opposed by broad sectors of the nation's most powerful elites and by the population as a whole. Well, we tend to romanticize the past, that all these people in the country were supporting the civil rights movement in the 60s. Well, if you go back and read the history of the civil rights movement in the 60s, and even at some of the peak moments, such as the March on Washington, August 28, 1963, 2 months later, Time magazine did a special on the Negro Revolution, and that even at that time, 1963, the majority of whites polled believed that blacks were moving too fast in the country. This is before the explosions in the northern cities of our country. So historically, therefore, for most of its existence, most of the existence of this society as a European colony and as an independent nation, it has been argued not only by Du Bois, but a number of other scholars, that the U.S. essentially has been a racial dictatorship. The brief, somewhat egalitarian experiment known as Reconstruction after the Civil War, 10, 15 years perhaps, was followed by almost a century of legally sanctioned apartheid that only fell legally, de jure segregation, in the mid-1960s. This apartheid history, mandated by law and upheld by terror, not just by law, behind the velvet glove of law was the terror of the KKK and other groups. This continued after World War I into the 1960s. Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson acted against it only after public protest, not before. They were never ahead of the civil rights struggle. Progressive changes were brought about by courageous blacks, especially returning veterans from World War II and Korea and Vietnam, by the implication and horror of the Holocaust in World War II, by the rising anti-colonial movements in the Third World, and, as evidenced by a growing and fine literature, by the impact of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. The period after World War II was particularly critical. In a very fine book called Cold War and Civil Rights, a professor at USC, Mary Dudziak, asserts that during that period, that is the Cold War period, the diplomatic impact of race in America led to civil rights reforms that were in part a product of the Cold War. Racial injustice here led to problems in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and race relations in the United States were profoundly shaped by external foreign relations, especially the conflict with the Soviet Union. The major concern for political leaders in the U.S. was how, quote, domestic events would influence the Cold War of balance. They never were committed to racial justice. That is, they never did the right thing for the right reason. They were always looking over their shoulder. They were always worried when, for example, ambassadors and other officials from Africa would not be allowed to stop on the roads, for example, between New York and Washington, D.C., and be served in restaurants in places like Maryland. Okay. These were terrible incidents. They made the U.S. look bad. Du Bois, of course, understood this international historical link. He argued that we could not understand the black experience in the U.S. without reference to the global context. He tied his critique of racism to capitalist exploitation of white labor in the North and black labor in the South, an exploitation, he said, was supported by a staggering level of violence and imperialism against people of color here and throughout the world. And we have voluminous historical literature documenting the argument that Du Bois made, from King Leopold in the Belgian Congo to South Africa to Indonesia, when you go through the British and the French and the Dutch, etc. So without the historical pressure of events and movements against racism, the Supreme Court in 1954 would never have unanimously decided that segregation in education was unconstitutional in Brown versus Board of Education. John Fitzgerald Kennedy does not make eloquent speeches on civil rights in 1963. Lyndon Baines Johnson does not get up before Congress and millions of Americans and say, "We shall overcome," without the movement, the struggle, the deaths of people, the imprisonment of thousands of others, the harassment by the FBI. So when you think about changes in the country, when you think about segregation being declared unconstitutional in 1954, you have to ask yourself, why wasn't it declared unconstitutional in 1904 or 1854, since blacks have been in the forefront since the rise of mass education in the United States in the struggles for equality in schooling? What changed? Not the Constitution and abstract laws. What changed was the social and historical climate in the United States, and what changed that were the struggles of ordinary Americans. That historical climate was challenged by the great human rights struggle of the 1950s and 60s, though of course it began before that, that transformed in many ways the political and cultural landscape of the United States. The work of these what have been called at times racial minority movements achieved limited but very powerful reforms for racial justice and equality in this country. The anti-racist movements of the 1960s redefined the meaning of racial identity and of race itself in this country. Manning Mirabel, among others, has argued that the very idea of sharply different races, our very conception of race, is a social creation, and that that conception has buttressed both white supremacy and class rule in the United States. And he argues that we have to understand not only why some people come to be black, Asian, Native American, but also, quote unquote, the invention of the white race. European immigrants, for example, did not just become Americans, they became white Americans. And there are two marvelous books on this subject. One is called How the Irish Became White, and the other is called Are Italians White? They both address this issue, the definition of immigrants coming to this country and how they define themselves. Many Irish immigrants, for example, in coming to the United States and facing oppression, sadly rejected the pleas of their great nationalist and anti-racist leader Daniel O'Connell in the 1840s to side with blacks and abolitionists against slavery. He reminded them that, quote, "It was not in Ireland that you learned this cruelty." Racism is not merely an attitude, it is deeply entrenched in practices, institutions, and structures. The attitudes have dramatically changed in this country. The structures and institutions remain very much in place. Racism directly sustains or proposes to establish a racial order, a hierarchical order, a permanent group hierarchy that is believed to reflect the laws of nature or the decrees of God. The divine arguments used to be stronger in the 17th, 18th, 19th century. The laws of nature, perhaps the laws of genetics, became stronger with the rise of eugenics in the early 20th century. Though given the rise of Christian fundamentalism, who knows? We may be going full circle in terms of the arguments to justify racism. Racism has two components: difference, but most importantly, power. To achieve its full development, let me back up for a minute because there's a little addition here I want to put in, that so that we don't merely see racism as simply an historical attribute of the United States merely being white against black. Michael Parenti, for example, in a book, Against Empire, argues that the earliest victims of the Western European notions of racism were actually other Europeans who were also Caucasian. For example, some 800 years ago, Ireland became the first colony of what later became known as the British Empire, and if you read the history of British colonialism in Ireland, you will see how the Irish were actually defined as a race, and comments made about them very akin to the comments made about blacks and other racial minorities in the U.S., and of course, the British absolutely savaged Ireland, burned villages, and as we talked about in our discussion of Columbus a couple of months ago, the British practiced in Ireland on the Irish what the British then later would do to indigenous peoples here in North America. Other early Caucasian victims of Western Europeans included Eastern Europeans, the people that Charlemagne worked to death in his mines in the early 9th century were Slavs. So frequent and prolonged, Parenti argues, was the enslavement of Eastern Europeans that Slav became synonymous with servitude, and indeed the word slave derives from the word Slav. So it's not just simply a black-white issue, but certainly in the West, racism as a political project has been from the oppressor, white Europeans, to those of color from Africa and on this continent. It's a political project. It creates or reproduces structures of domination based on essential categories of race. Some scholars argue that this project or modern conception of race did not occur until the rise of Europe and the arrival of Europeans in the Americas. Therefore, the conquest begun by Columbus, it has been argued, was perhaps the first and greatest racial formation project in human history, and that this project was also linked, as we discussed 2 or 3 months ago, to the rising anti-Semitism and attacks on Jews in Europe at the same time. For those of you who are here in our discussion of Columbus, you recall that essentially the same month, almost to the same day, that the three ships left, Columbus's ships left Spain, ships left the same harbor with Jews having been expelled from Spain by Queen Isabella. They almost literally crossed each other in the harbor. The enduring foundation of racism or white supremacy is the belief that Euro-Americans of white ancestry, especially Northern and Western Europeans, are collectively superior in intelligence and creativity to other people. Therefore, the dominant ideas on race are created and sustained by rulers who must maintain a system of ideas and practices that then become our common sense. And that common sense then is passed on in schools, in the media, in religious institutions. White supremacy or racism is perhaps the most fundamental common sense in U.S. history, something that has been woven through the major institutions and social relations in law, in political organizations, in the economy, in religion, in cultural life, in residential patterns, in education, etc. Going back to Manning Marable, Marable argues in terms of the racial dynamics that without a racialized other, whites would cease to exist. The whole conception of what it is to be white would cease to exist. He reminds us that the memorable phrase, "All men are created equal," written by Thomas Jefferson, had absolutely nothing to do with black people, whether they were enslaved or legally free, or indigenous Americans / American Indians. The founding fathers understood, when you read them, you study that history, brilliant political insights, by the way. Whatever we may think of their political, economic, philosophic, cultural views, no group of rulers in this society gave as much thought to running a country as those group of men did 200 plus years ago. People today, the best you can name in the 20th century group of individuals, don't even come close to Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton. When we read their arguments, they understood, though, that the language of equality did not apply to black people, the people from Africa in the Caribbean, who by common consent had been excluded from civilized government and the family of nations and doomed, almost all of them, to slavery. So it's this legacy that this generation confronts, a horrific one that enslaved, killed, and demeaned tens of millions of people and has poisoned the moral and political fabric of the country. Du Bois argued more than a century ago, of course, that the color line would be the most fundamental problem of the 20th century, and we're now in the 21st, and I would argue that he is right when we look at what is happening in the world. So we need, here we are in a group talking about U.S. history, we need to have an accurate memory. We need to resurrect a critical historical understanding of what actually has happened through the whole period, the colonies, the colonization of the United States, the invasion we talked about, and then the formal political history since 1776, and then with the establishment of the Constitution and the first president in 1789. That is, we need to have a memory, an accurate memory, that emerges from a critical historical understanding of where we have been, what actually happened, and why. If we do not have that, we do not know where we are now, and we have no guidelines for the future.
You've been listening to Dr. John Marciano, Professor Emeritus at SUNY Cortland. He was delivering a lecture on chapters from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States as part of his free public class in Los Angeles. We continue with the question period that followed his commentary.
Questions, comments, arguments?
My name is Teresa. As I was listening to how many different societies engaged in slavery and racism throughout history, the question to me is not who has participated in it, but who hasn't, if any culture. You know, we know that it's not just black and white. The North Koreans don't like the South Koreans. The Chinese don't like the Japanese. The British don't like the Irish. And it's just, is there any society that has ever existed that didn't have that sort of thing? Any tribes in Africa or anywhere? It's a question.
Well, in terms of, and other people can help me in terms of the knowledge of anthropology, but just in looking at Zinn's chapter, we don't have an exhaustive list. For example, formal chattel slavery, the ownership, as far as I know, in more recent history, of course, I mean, the North Koreans or the South Koreans haven't owned each other. We're talking about an ownership master-slave relationship. We know from Zinn's chapter that the so-called savages that Columbus encountered, the Taino, did not hold slaves. As far as I know, the member nations of the Iroquois Confederacy did not hold slaves. So there are examples. It's not a universal aspect of human history. We're talking about a very specific, not talking about just oppressing people. I mean, for example, I'm reading now some Greek and Roman history, and the Greeks and the Romans took slaves, conquered people, and took slaves. But we're talking about a very specific form of slavery, which Du Bois, Eric Williams, and other scholars argue was very unique to the American or U.S. form of slavery, and their argument is that that particular kind of historical slavery really began with the Columbus, in which he took some of the natives from those islands, not just as conquered, and then it becomes an actual financial situation when slaves become commodified. So if there are people here who've done more research in anthropology, please jump in.
You brought up the question of the North Koreans and South Koreans. Well, that was an arbitrary line that was set down by the United States, just like North Vietnam and South Vietnam. There's no such thing as North Koreans and South Koreans. They're all Koreans. That kind of hatred the Japanese had towards the Koreans is more of an example, but it was never, and it was formulated as a slavery type of thing too, but it still was different than capitalist slavery, is what you can call it, I guess. That was formulated particularly by the United States. It was done a little bit in Europe, but it didn't last in Europe very long. The English did it for a little while, but then the English outlawed it. But it's something that's pretty unique to what we have. One point I wanted to make, too, was about the Klan-type organizations. I remember years ago the posses became fashionable, and I remember books being put out that was drawing the attentions that the people that were running the posses were leaders of the Klan and the Nazis and things of that nature. And today we have the Minutemen who, well, I haven't seen the evidence yet, but I can swear that it's got that same leadership passed down to it and being directed towards other peoples. One other thing that's very important in the news these days, and that's destruction of any kind of alliance between the Mexican and other Latin American peoples and African Americans. I remember back in the 60s even that one of the things that the state was really trying to eliminate was any kind of coalition between those peoples as being two of the largest, most oppressed peoples in the United States.
Just a brief comment that in addition to the issue of slavery, of course, in these chapters, he's talking about the systematic development of racism in the United States, essentially directed, though not totally directed, just at people of African descent, in which it becomes institutionalized, as I indicated, in every single aspect of American life. It is legalized, it is upheld by the state courts, it is upheld by the federal courts, it is upheld by the Supreme Court. It's come down to us decade after decade, and the progressive changes that happen, because this is not 1930s Mississippi. There would be no trial of anyone in Mississippi if it were 1930s for killing a black man and two white men who were supporting him, which of course has been fictionalized. A number of you, I'm sure, have seen Mississippi Burning, a very historically distorted film that makes out the FBI to be heroes. Well, if you read the actual history of what happened in the South under J. Edgar Hoover, that is not what the FBI was doing in the South. In some ways, they were working hand in hand with the Klan. But those changes have happened so that things are different in this country as opposed to 40 years ago because of what people did and because of, tragically, the deaths of those three young men and others. That history is being erased, by the way, or revised, to make it appear that those who then opposed any movement for justice for black people somehow supported it. And that's why we need to go back and really look at the documents.
My name is Hartley. I was going to raise something. I want to get to the crux of it. This is an issue that I've tried to figure out a long time, what I'm saying to you. I don't understand it. I mean, John has done an excellent job here of describing what happened. But what I don't understand, I never really have been able to understand, is why it happened. I mean, we've had virulent hatred of African Americans for 400 years. I mean, you talk about it in terms of, well, there was an economic aspect to it for slavery, they made money, profits, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you know, there's different reasons. But for it to last so long, and it appears to me to still be very prevalent among everybody. I was a teacher for 30 years, and I was a union rep for 20 of those 30 years, and I had the most liberal teachers around me through most of my working career. And they were very liberal people, and they believed in everything that you people probably believe in. And they were racist. And it came out subtly in their humor and their attitude, their comments about just things in the news. I'll tell you one small story. I was traveling on a train in Europe once, and I was a young man. I was in my 20s, and there was a guy there who was also in his 20s, a German. And we started talking, and I somehow moved the conversation around to what happened to the Jews. And he kind of intimated that that was his parents' generation, and his generation didn't feel responsibility, that kind of thing. And I got a little miffed at that and kind of intimated that maybe he should accept some of the responsibility. And he stopped cold and he looked at me and he said, "You Americans are something else." He said, "Well, whenever I ask an American such as yourself about slavery and about lynchings, for example, you always say, well, that happened in the South. And I'm a Northerner, I'm a Westerner, I'm not a part of that." But when Germans say, "Well, that was my parents' generation," or "That was the Nazis," you won't let us off the hook. You tell us that everybody in Germany is responsible. Well, if everybody in Germany is responsible for what happened to the Jews, then everybody in the United States is responsible for what happened to African Americans in this country. And that makes me responsible for lynchings. I mean, it's really hard for me to get my head around that, but that's what it means. And this conversation with this young man happened 30 years ago. I just don't understand.
You don't understand
this country where I live.
I mean, that is, you don't have any theoretical explanation for why this unfolded in this society?
Yeah, I used to teach history. I have a theoretical explanation, I need to go beyond that. I don't have the psychological explanation. I don't see how such a hatred could be so strong in contemporary society or in the society that I grew up in over the last 50 years.
Well, Du Bois would argue, for example, is that often psychology follows other things, one of them being the dollar sign, that psychology follows sociology and history. And we think of chattel slavery. Think of the beginning of the slave trade in the Western world. Europe, the United States, the Caribbean, to South America. No, but I'm saying is that in terms of trying to get to the roots of issues, I mean, there are contemporary manifestations of this. There are slave-like conditions which still exist in the United States, but official, documented, legalized chattel slavery ended in the United States with the Civil War. Now, Du Bois and others would argue that there are tangible reasons. There's not some irrational hatred that white people are born with that they want to enslave black people. Right? Otherwise, it would be hard to explain why the British essentially enslaved the Irish, why Western Europeans enslaved the Slavs. That there are tangible things that people get. And the psyche, in a sense, is connected to that. Ideologies develop to rationalize it. Preachers come out of the woodwork, especially in the South, telling people, including blacks, every Sunday that God designed this world. This has happened. It's found in the book of Genesis, and it's this, and it's Cain and Abel, etc. I mean, the libraries are filled with actually some very fine historical works to give us a handle on where this came from. And that's part of what Zinn is trying to get at, that it's not some...
Why is it still here?
Well, it's still here because it benefits. I mean, this is the issue of power. It benefits people. It is not some irrational... I mean, think of Mississippi. Think of 40 years ago in Mississippi. The Klan, the sheriffs. I'm sure all of you remember 40 years ago, those shots of Sheriff Rainey and those other cracker sheriffs sitting around chewing tobacco. I still have, you know, this image. Maybe that's the stereotype locked in my head. But they're sitting around laughing in their hearing, okay? Their power, and in a sense, many times they were the goons for people with greater power. Their power, the power of the planters, the power of the corporations in Mississippi, those things get undermined if black people get power, get economic and political power. So they're real manifestations of why that it's not irrational. They get power. Goodman and Cheney and Schwerny organize people, and Stokely Carmichael and Fannie Lou Hamer and Malcolm, etc. They organize people in Mississippi and elsewhere. The power shifts in the country. That means the people, you know, and it's not a win-win game, by the way. Okay? It's not a win-win game. It's a conflict. It's a fundamental conflict. The folks in Mississippi running that state for decades, they lose power to black people. They have to lose power in order for black people to gain it. That's what happens. And they're going to develop a whole psychological makeup, and they're going to teach in their schools, and they still do, about these kinds of things. And that's rooted, and then we grow in our families to hate, to have this bitter hatred. But it's institutionalized. The attitudes of hate, the overt manifestations of hate, have subsided in U.S. society. But other aspects, for example, black unemployment vis-a-vis white unemployment is worse today than 40 years ago. Black infant mortality. That's what Du Bois and others mean by institutionalized racism. It's not that, you know, a group of doctors want black kids to die more than white kids or anybody wills this, but if you just take resources out of some communities, and of course thinking of the South again, most of the poorest counties in the United States are not in urban areas in the North, they're in the South, and they're in American Indian or Native American reservations. That's where the poverty is. So, forgive me for carrying on.
In response to the question, where has slavery not happened, I read a book called Slavery and Social Death. I've forgotten the name of the author, but he was, I think he was a professor at Harvard, and so it was a fairly well-researched thing that he did. And his finding was that no major civilization that he had come across had achieved its greatness without slavery. And I'll try and remember to bring the book in for show and tell next time.
So Rome, Greece, the British Empire, France, the U.S., etc. All right.
Hello, I'm Bob. John, you mentioned earlier that Ronald Reagan began his 1980 campaign in Philadelphia. Was there any official Philadelphia, Mississippi, right? And was there any official context given for him being there? What was the Republican line on that? Do you recall? Because I don't remember hearing anything about it, truthfully.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall the context other than Reagan, in a sense, following sort of the political shift that actually began with Goldwater in 64. As you recall, Lyndon Johnson won overwhelmingly. Goldwater won a few states in the South. And a number of people have argued that that was the beginning of the clear message to whites, especially in the South, to desert the Democratic Party and move to the Republican Party that would be much more aggressive and militant in defending white privilege. I don't know who his campaign manager was at that time. It wasn't Karl Rove, by the way. But it reminds me of the kind of thing that Karl Rove would be. Because Reagan, of course, could have started his campaign in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at the site of the Liberty Bell, but not in a majority black city at that time. That's 25 years ago. But I think it was a message. You know, they talked a lot about states' rights. I remember, because there have been some articles. He talked a lot about states' rights. And when you talk about states' rights south of the Mason-Dixon line in the 1960s and beyond, you don't have to have a sign that said, you know, or a Dixie flag, you know, or with those Confederate stickers on those big trucks of guys with guns who don't just live in Mississippi. So the people got the word. People got the word. And they understood what Reagan was saying about the South and racism.
Hi, I'm Barbara. I just have a hypothesis to put out there in this struggle with the question of where does our capacity to be so cruel and devaluing of other human beings. I think it starts way before the fears and the structural part of it, and the political part of it, and the economic part of it. And being a psychologist, my hypothesis is that I think we learn it at very young ages by the way we treat our children, by the way throughout centuries we've treated women and children, but children, as non-humans, without respect, as property. And I think at those early ages is the beginning seeds of being able to look at any other group or being or nature in the world, of being able to be cold and distant and devaluing. I think we learn it at young ages by being devalued ourselves.
But how does it, remember, we're talking about a very specific phenomenon now, that is the categorization of an entire group of people on the basis of, let's say, for want of a better term, skin color, all right? That people can clearly see there are differences among people in the world, all right? There are diversity among the human race as there's diversity in the natural world. What is it about the development of children that is linked to this specific, because it seems to me you're talking about a generalized devaluing of children. We're sort of worthless as children. How do we end up, though, with a very specific kind of hatred? That is, I don't end up hating all groups, but I end up hating African Americans or Japanese Americans. I mean, they're different forms of racism. Or Jews. I mean, because that kind of racism is linked in terms of African Americans and Jews. But so how does the psychology of childhood get shaped into a very specific form of virulent, and this is virulent, where we people in this society actually organized. They organized parties. They didn't just lynch people. They had parties, and there's a traveling show in the United States based on postcards. I think it's now in New York, James Allen or someone, where people would actually send cards of the event. You know, we were in Tuscaloosa, and we had this party, and you know, and they have photos of people being lynched. So it's, how does this specific phenomenon come from the generalized demeaning of childhood?
As an aside to that, I sang in a barbershop choir at one point, and they wanted us to sing this song called The Cakewalk, and it was about picnics and cakewalks. And I looked at them, and I said, do you know what this song is singing about? And it was singing about lynchings. That's what the picnics and the cakewalk was about back then, and because I could not sing that song. To your question, again, it's a hypothesis struggling with this question of how we can be so cruel. I think part is geography, you know, being showing, having differences in whatever resources are available or aren't. But again, it stems from this early childhood ability or support of creating lines and boundaries and differences and seeing everything in categories of different and other rather than all and together and as a, you know, world team.